The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
On 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show is brought to you by Absa CIB, building investment and growing businesses in Africa. The bravery to imagine that's Africa. Nasity Absa is a registered FSP. What do you make of the shenanigans in Parliament? EFF up to its old tricks of destabilizing the parliamentary process. It was very effective in the days of Jacob Zuma, and it feels a little bit hypocritical to look at it now and to go, oh, for goodness sake, grow up and get a new strategy, actually engage in a debate, bring some evidence, and don't accuse somebody of a criminal act if you yourself are accused of a criminal act. VBS, three letters, very simple. Eskom this evening is asking you please to switch off everything that, other than your life support machine if you're on one, because of a power shortage as we go into the weekend. I'm forecasting power outages and blackouts and rolling blackouts and what's it called, load shedding from Monday. As a big frontal system hits the Western Cape, and no doubt will bring icy cold weather across not only the Western Cape but the rest of the country next week. And what we do know from previous experience is these cold fronts at a time of electricity scarcity do lead to blackouts. And with the system as vulnerable as it is, as we are being warned that it is tonight at 6 p.m., then brace yourself for load shedding next week. It is likely inevitable that it will occur. We'll catch up with Lyndon Burns in just a moment, the managing director at Plain Talking. He is well plugged into South Africa's airline industry, and he knows very, very clearly the history of South Africa's airline industry. And it's been very, very entrepreneurial. It's been quite traumatic for many entrepreneurs. We've certainly lost more airlines than we have in service in the last decade right now. So we'll talk to him about that in just a little bit. But just some reflections before we get to Lyndon Burns about the biggest story of the day. And the biggest story of the day is American inflation, which has come in at 8.6%. That is higher than the 8.3% that was expected. And that number came out today, and prices in the US rising faster than expected last month. Energy and food costs. We know all too well, of course, about energy and food costs in South Africa. They are the fastest rising components of our own inflation basket, which at this stage remains just, well, the last check below 6%. It's likely to go slightly above that in the next time we actually take its temperature. But inflation at its highest rate in the United States since 1981. And inflation proving the old adage that inflation's a lot like toothpaste. Once it's out of the tube, it's impossible to get back in again. And once you've squeezed it out. And so American inflation, you think to yourself, well, it doesn't affect me. Well, it most certainly does affect you, because the US Central Bank has been raising interest rates in that economy since March. And what we've been doing in South Africa is front-running inflation, trying to get ahead of it, trying to cut it off before it sort of breaches the barriers, of course, of 3 to 6%. But Americans have left their inflation to run unchecked, pretty much like the European Central Bank has done as well. It announced yesterday that it would begin raising interest rates by just a quarter of 1% from next month, as their inflation rate went over 8% as well. Now, these are economies that are not used to high inflation rates, not used to the volatility with which we are used to contending. And so as they look at higher interest rates coming, they're getting into a flat panic. And we're seeing Americans begin to sell assets. We're seeing mortgage applications fall off a cliff. We're seeing consumer confidence in the United States plummet. And it's not helped by the fact that Russia invaded Ukraine, and that's driven up the price of oil and key commodities like wheat and maize, for example. And food prices are rocketing. The oil price is rocketed. It's putting up the cost of absolutely everything. And a breakdown of the latest CPI data reveals that while energy inflation remains problematic, it certainly is also the food price issue, which is absolutely enormous, not just in the United States, but for us in South Africa as well. So we are going into tougher times. Of that, there is no doubt. Certainly, Barclays has become the first of the big global banks to say that the US has left this thing too late, inflation problem too late. What did Michael Jordan say yesterday? That the European Central Bank is behind the Fed and the Fed is behind the curve. Well, the Barclays today is saying the Fed will have to raise interest rates by 75 basis points next week. That's an astonishingly high rate and a very volatile rate. The last time the US Fed raised interest rates by 75 basis points was in November 1994. And the time before that was 1984. It's a very rare occurrence, and it is a signal of some concern about what is happening in terms of the US inflation rate. And yes, it does all go full circle and come back to bite us at the southern tip of Africa, as we need to keep a pace, of course, with global interest rates rising. And it's not going to be popular, and it's certainly going to make life a lot tougher.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
So what do SAA, Fly Safair, Airlink and Lyft have in common? They're still in business. And it's probably decades since South Africa had so few airlines competing for business across our skies. Lyndon Burns, the managing director at Plain Talking. There was a time, of course, when it was just SAA, Lyndon Burns. Then there was deregulation, and suddenly it became almost a frenzied free-for-all where anybody with a bit of capital and an aeroplane and a license could apply to fly across South African skies. And we've seen many, many airlines come and go, but it's been a long time since we've had so few operating.
Hi, Bruce, and everyone listening. Yeah, indeed. I mean, it's 1991 when we deregulated, when South Africa deregulated the domestic market, and that brought with it competition, choice, and lower prices because it forced efficiencies into the market. And yes, you know, we've seen a number of people throw their hats in the ring and have a go. It's interesting that today is also the 30th anniversary of Airlink since its establishment, and so they, you know, we looked before at you know, at Airlink and at Comair as really kind of bellwethers of the industry from the private sector, because they were the two most consistent operators and the only ones that had been continuously operating from that time, from deregulation. Fly Safair is a relatively new entrant. It's only been in the market, I'm not even sure it's even been 10 years yet, but it's now, you know, got a 60% market share with the exit of Comair.
It's astonishing. And then Lyft, of course, is still tiny, and we've been running very very restricted routes, but I was talking to get on Novik last night, and they've got big plans.
Yeah, so I mean, if I just put it, give you some numbers, okay? So, and this is data from Cirium, one of the industry trackers, if you like. So, Comair's operations would have accounted for 19,000 planned domestic flights for which it was already possible to make advanced bookings. And that's about a quarter of all the domestic flights in the system. In seat number terms, it's about one-third of the available capacity that would be lost. So, we're going from 9.7 million to 6.5 million seats available in the domestic market. But there was broad consensus that the local market was overtraded because we had a glut of capacity. And we saw the likes of Comair having to defend their market share by selling seats at sub-economic loss leader prices. The remaining guys, the Lyft, the Airlinks, the Samair, and the Fly Safair, they're going to be able to fill that capacity gap. They've all had plans to add more aircraft to their fleets over the coming weeks, and Samair is adding aircraft every month. Airlink have got three more aircraft coming in soon. The one airline that's not been able to get more aircraft is Lyft, and I spoke to Gidon yesterday as well, and he said to me, we need aircraft yesterday, but Global Aviation, which supplies their aircraft and their crew, doesn't have any spare aircraft at the moment because they're all committed to European operations during the Northern Hemisphere summer. So they, you know, they're going to get left behind. SAA is expected to ramp up operations, and if things turn positive for Mango and their business rescue practitioners do succeed in finding an equity partner, it could also be back on the runway. So it's going to be interesting, and I don't believe this is necessarily the end of the road for Comair, and I'll tell you why. It's going into liquidation. I'm wondering, and this is speculation, but it has happened before in our industry in South Africa. I'm wondering if there's not somebody holding out to pick up the assets at a fire sale price from the liquidator.
It wouldn't be beyond the realms of possibility. It certainly wouldn't. In the short term, a lack of capacity means higher prices, also higher prices as a result of an oil price at $120 a barrel. I mean, there's so many factors acting as a huge constraints for the airline industry right now. But the point is, we've got lots of passengers, not enough seats, and that's going to create scarcity.
I don't know if we've got a shortage of seats, to be absolutely honest, though. We're still at 25% below 2019 levels, and the airlines have been very reluctant to flood capacity back into the market. We've grown by 116% so far this year compared with this time last year, but a year ago we were still less than half of pre-pandemic traffic volume. So I think they've been very cautious, because it's one thing adding capacity and selling the capacity, but if you're not able to command fares that cover your costs, then you're not going to make money. All you're going to do is mitigate your losses. And we're in a period where we're trying to recover from the pandemic and the losses that were made. So, most of the last year and a half, airlines will operate to reduce their losses, not necessarily to generate a positive margin.
So where does it leave us then, Lyndon? I mean, in terms of the airline industry, the survivors are in pretty good shape, aren't they?
Look, the recovery has been good until now, but now we're facing, and you've just spoken about the impact of the Russia-Ukraine situation and the spike in the oil prices. It's worth noting that the gap between the premium price of jet fuel versus crude has opened up significantly over the last month. It used to be pretty much track at about a $20 premium. It's opened up to $60 a barrel, that premium. That's 900 grand a barrel. And now that we have to import most of our crude and all of our jet fuel in South Africa, bar a relatively small volume that Sasol produces through coal to oil processes, this has got to be the single biggest thing keeping airline CFOs and revenue managers awake at night, because we've not even begun thinking about or talking about the additional cost of transporting that fuel from Durban or Maputo to the reef. And we saw what happened last month when the fuel supplies were disrupted by the flood damage and the vandalism of the rail infrastructure. And then we've got to add to that the new carbon tax, which now applies to domestic air. So that's another level of tax. Now the EU wants to apply its emissions trading scheme taxes to all flights to, from, and across the EU, regardless of where they end or start. And that applies to all journeys from South Africa or to South Africa. So that's going to be a deterrent, and it's going to add another layer of cost to travel and tourism. We're going to see what happens. Next week is the big industry forecast on the 20th of June. IATA publishes its latest industry forecast and state of the industry report. That's at its AGM in Doha.
It's going to be a turbulent and tumultuous time, but I suppose if there is a little bit of luck in the timing of the collapse of Comair, it is that it is in the winter months in South Africa, which are not peak tourism months, and as tourism was showing signs of recovery, and I know that the Tourism Business Council is really worried about this. Where do we sit?
Bruce, I don't necessarily agree with you. I speak to some of the long-haul operators. Remember, our winter is their summer holiday. And a lot of them want to come here to discover what we have to offer, especially safaris. And I was talking to, for example, the people at United Airlines. Their flights to and from South Africa are mostly travel originating in the U.S. The flights are operating at more or less 80 or 90% full at the moment. And they've just gone to all year round on Cape Town starting this week. And that's a very strong sign of demand for travel. And the local airlines rely on that travel, on that traffic to feeder. You know, that feeds and fuels the domestic market, and it provides additional forex revenue coming into the market today.
Lyndon Burns, thank you for your deep insights this evening. He is at O.R. Tambo International Airport this evening, the Managing Director at Plane Talking, Lyndon Burns. His insights into the state of the airline industry, which is had too musty. Airline tickets were being sold for a song. I got some tickets between Joburg and Cape Town the other day for less than $1,000. It was brilliant. But here's the consequence. Airlines go out of business when they can't fly profitably. So we will see costs going up. And in the rules of the airline industry, you do need to book early. You do need to get your tickets booked as early as possible. And you need to stick to those tickets. Don't change them, because unless you're on Lyft, which has been quite innovative in terms of their ability to switch flights and stuff, you really are going to incur additional costs. So if you want to keep your fare costs down, then it certainly is a very, very important strategy to book early and then stick to those bookings as much as you possibly can. And yes, it's tragic that Comair and Kalula.com have gone. As Lyndon Burns says, though, perhaps, there's a tiny fraction of an opportunity, that somebody is lurking in the shadows, waiting to pick up those assets for an absolute song. And yeah, lots of people bemoaning the loss of the BA tail for South Africa. And I wonder if British Airways would extend the privilege of carrying that brand, that livery, to anyone else. I can't imagine they would. They've been burned quite badly by this experience. But yeah, let's have a look at this one. Thank you, Lyndon Burns. In a moment, Patrick Matidi. Patrick is the head of equities at Aluwani Capital Partners. Talk to him about the big story today, which is the inflation number out of the United States. Why that matters more than you can possibly imagine.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
Markets have had an absolutely awful day across the globe. We've seen European markets fall very, very sharply, between 2 and 3%. US markets about 2% lower on the day. And the JSE, by the close, lost 1 2/3%. The all-share index down to 67,800, more than 1,100 points lower. And it was all because of an American inflation number that was worse than expected. That American inflation number, Karabo, if you could put Patrick on, please, because my system has just failed me. Patrick Matidi is the head of equities at Aluwani Capital Partners. And Patrick, that American inflation number at 8.6% is the number that has scared the living daylights out of everybody. It was meant to come in at 8.2, maybe 8.3%, came in at 8.6, and that sent a signal of fear, terror, and apprehension to American investors.
Yeah, good evening, and always a pleasure to be on the show. Absolutely, I mean, it was such a weighted number. You'll recall a few days ago, we did see the jobs report coming through, which gave us, you know, some hope that perhaps, you know, things are, you know, turning the corner in terms of that economy. But certainly, the latest reading in the CPI for the U.S. at 8.6, you know, it's a multi-decade high. I think it's about a 40-year high, if I'm not mistaken. And just to give you some context of how high we have come, you know, January 2021, we were sitting at about 1.4, right? So 1.4 all the way up to 8.6. It's a massive, massive rise. Yeah. And hence, you know, the market also being a lot more jittery in terms of where the peak is, you know, given that the last reading we had thought that would be the peak.
Yeah, it certainly isn't. And it's food and it's energy. And these are the two most important components of any household's expenditure. And that's the thing that voters feel most. And it's leading to huge amounts of disruption around the world. It's affecting absolutely every single human being on the planet, because everything that we consume is transported. Everything that we consume is costing more. And it's going to have some fairly devastating impacts on economies across the globe for at least the foreseeable future.
Well, absolutely. I mean, we've already seen, you know, the likes of the World Bank and the IMF actually downgrading the outlook for global GDP. And certainly, you know, this inflation is actually providing a lot of headwinds, you know, on that front. But also you will have the second round effects coming through in the form of higher interest rates, you know, to try and tame this runaway inflation. And certainly, if you look at the bond markets and across the globe, they are starting to price in a lot more aggressive stance than perhaps, you know, one would have seen with the last round of inflation prints.
Barclays saying tonight that they're expecting a 0.75% or a 75 basis point increase in interest rates by the US Fed next week. That last happened in 1994, and it happened before that in 1984, with some fairly desperate measures by the US Fed in those days to tame inflation. It looks like we're headed back to the wild west of inflation taming again.
Yeah, I mean, especially if you go back to the 80s, you know, we did have that oil crisis earlier on in the 70s, and then you also had what you now call the Volcker moment, you know, where the then Fed, you know, a chairperson had to be very aggressive in terms of taming inflation. But I guess the question now, Bruce, is, you know, is the Fed ahead of the curve, behind the curve, and what is the likely move going forward, and what is the likely impact, you know, that will have on financial markets?
Well, the markets at the moment think it's all to hell in a handbasket. And I wonder how you are reading this market at the moment, because the University of Michigan comes out with a U.S. consumer confidence number and has come out at a record low of 50.2. They've never seen U.S. consumer confidence this low, not even in the global financial crisis of 2008.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've also seen a similar measure coming out of the UK, which also points to a very gloomy outlook from a consumer point of view. And the factors are well known, well documented. It's all about, you know, inflation, higher energy prices, and higher food prices. And if you look at the sort of the outlook of that survey, people are not confident that the authorities will have this under control for the foreseeable future, which is also, you know, not a great sort of omen in terms of the authorities and their ability to actually tame inflation. On the local side, Bruce, we are also cautiously optimistic, but we think that we won't be left unscathed, especially since a lot of our inflation is also imported. If you look at the energy prices, and then therefore we are sort of in the basket if you look at what's happening in our markets.
I mean, do you, the Reserve Bank, I think, was anticipating another 325 basis point increases this year, then raised rates at the last MPC by 50 basis points, which has scared quite a lot of people. Just how aggressive do you think our central bank is going to be in the face of what's likely to be far more aggressive tightening out of the United States, and even the European Central Bank announcing yesterday it will begin to raise rates too?
Yeah, Bruce, if you look at the bond market, especially the forward market, I mean, as any indication, it is clear that, one, this inflation number was not well expected, and the quantum of the move, you know, about 25 basis points of our bond market, starts to indicate, you know, a much more aggressive stance that is required, you know, from the MPC if we have any chance at all of actually taming this inflation and remaining within our band. So certainly, you know, the better off. All markets are looking for a lot more aggressive sort of stance from the MPC going forward.
Patrick Matidi, thank you. He is the head of equities at Aluwani Capital Partners. There's only one story in the world today, and that's the fear of inflation story. There were a couple of other tales and some interesting ones. African Rainbow Capital came out with an update today. This is Patrice Motsepe's business of African Rainbow Capital. And one of the most exciting assets within that portfolio at the moment is Time Bank. And Time Bank South Africa and Time Global, concluding a Series B capital raising round. They've raised $70 million with Tencent, that's Naspers's Tencent, and the UK's development finance institution, the CDC Group, becoming new shareholders in Time. This is allowing, of course, Patrice Motsepe, who stepped in and bought 90% of Time when the Commonwealth Bank of Australia pulled out, allowing him to realise some value from that, taking a bet on Time Bank. And, of course, Time Bank has got some exciting growth options happening in the Philippines as well. Goes beyond just pick and pay. Also today, the Foschini Group announcing it's made a nearly 3 billion rand profit in the year to the end of March. That's after a nearly 2 billion rand loss the year before. That was the hard lockdown year. I suppose the most interesting thing coming out of that Foschini update today is that online sales now make up more than 10% of total sales, which by global standards is low, but by South African standards, something fundamental is changing in retail.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa CIB, building investment and growing businesses in Africa. The bravery to imagine, that's Africanacity. Absa's a registered FSP.
Welcome to The Money Show. We're going to talk about a wine museum. I think it's a very new wine museum. It's just been started at Babylonstoren, which is the Becker's wine farm, sort of wedged between, got Stellenbosch on one side, Franschhoek over there, Paarl over there. But I think it's probably closest to Paarl. If you were going to go for a bottle of milk, you'd probably, well, you go to a local farm stall. But if you wanted a bottle of commercial milk, you would go into Paarl. That's the closest area. On the next Money Show, the guy who signs the country's banknotes and makes critical decisions on the future of your money is the Reserve Bank Governor Lesetša Ganyaho. He's going to join us as our main guest on the Next Money Show to talk about the state of the economy, talk about the interest rate cycle, and of course the global battle to wrestle with inflation, particularly as global inflation numbers look terrifying. Deep insight with the Reserve Bank Governor next time on the Money Show. We will also have Bronwyn Williams doing a book review for us and political analyst Mkhubi Sintlejana joining us on Other People's Money, a packed money show on your next show.
The Money Show.
The Friday File.
The Friday File.
Let's go to a wine museum. Virtually, of course. I can't take you there as much as I'd love to. But the story of the wine museum by Babylon Stuer, and Elsa Fuchs is the museologist, or the museum keeper, the person in charge of the museum at Babylon Stuoren. Elsa, where did the idea for the museum at Babylon Stuoren come from?
Well, Bruce, the idea for the museum came, I think, quite organically. We thought, what can we add to the Babylon Stuoren experience for our guests? That is a sort of a logical outflow from the experience of wine on the farm. And a museum was sort of the logical choice. And you'll find the museum sort of adjacent to the tasting room. So it's a really an experience which complements the wine experience for guests that we do offer.
I mean, we're making wine as humans for about 4,000, maybe 5,000 years. It's written about in the Bible. It's written about in ancient texts. How do you choose a starting point? Do you go back 350 years to the Dutch planting of the first vines at Wynberg, or do you go back further than that?
Well, we do a little bit of both at the Story of Wine. So we do look at a little bit of the ancient history of wine, and we like to tell our stories through objects as opposed to through a lot of text. So we've got quite an impressive audio guide that if you were to listen to it in its entirety, it would probably take you an hour or two to move through the museum. But the reason for choosing an audio guide as opposed to lots of text is it's a different medium, and visitors can really choose how long they want to engage with each part of the history of wine. So we do offer different lengths of experience, and we start with the ancient history. We focus a little bit on South African history in particular, which I think is quite important. And I think that's one of the main draw cards for our museum is to tell the story of South African wine is quite unique. And then we also have a little bit of history about glasses, about wine, wine bottles, and the different vessels that wine comes in. And we also touch a little bit upon the history of South African wine that's a little bit darker as well, the dop system and that.
Completely, and the links to slavery. I'm going to get there in just a moment. But has anybody ever worked out who the first person ever was who went, oh, these delicious crispy little balls of fruit that grow on these vine things, I know what's a good idea. I'm going to squeeze them, and then I'm going to leave the skins of these red ones in this earthenware jar. I'm going to let them rot, and then I'm going to drink it, and it's going to be fabulous. I mean, do we have any idea who the first twit was who discovered that?
Well, I can't say that we know the absolute person or their name, but I mean, I would say it would be the Persians back in sort of biblical times that came up with the idea.
So and Persia is the origin of wine. That we've got a lot to thank the Persians for.
Yes, I'm not a historical expert on that subject specifically, but I would venture to guess somewhere around Persia or in the Middle East, the first attempts were made, and I suppose it probably would have been happy accidents, if my guess were correct. So.
No, and look, thank goodness for happy accidents, because we're left with the result today, which is absolutely marvellous. I mean, so much of the history of South Africa, particularly the history of South Africa, I think the first vines are planted when? 1659 or thereabouts. It's certainly in the early days of the Dutch occupation of South Africa, certainly of the Western Cape. And the first vines are planted, and they're planted with a particular view of making wine. But over time, you start getting a proliferation of wine farms, and then labor is required, and then it becomes the sort of almost a catalyst for slavery and the importation of human beings, into the Western Cape. And of course, we've got the Slave Lodge, which is a very poignant reminder just next mm-hmm. to where Parliament used to be, which is mm-hmm. a reminder of the slave history of South Africa. And Vergelegen does a fine job of tying in much of the slave history. Do you go into that mm-hmm. slave history? You say you address the dark history of wine. Do you go there?
We don't go into a lot of detail about the slave history, but we do address the dorp system specifically, because it is something that is not very well known, especially from an international viewpoint. So what we actually did for the Wine Museum is we went and found a gentleman in Franschhoek whose father was still part of the dorp system. And it's actually quite difficult to find people in the Boerland who still have ties with the system, because it is so archaic, and it was fascinating to hear his story. And we made a lovely video that we have on display at the museum, just to sort of show what the legacy is.
Well, the dorp system, for anybody who doesn't know, I mean, it was being paid in wine in lieu of cash, and it created generations of people with substance abuse problems, with alcoholism, and it turned out mm-hmm. to have a devastating legacy.
Exactly. So we don't want to shy away from the difficult topics, even though that's not the focus of the museum overall. We do feel a responsibility to address those issues.
But certainly wine as a draw card for South Africa, wine as a poster for South Africa. The most wonderful thing about wine and how it differentiates itself from any other consumable anywhere. I mean, an apple's an apple is an apple, and we produce some great fruit in South Africa. But if you're going to have a golden, delicious apple, you're not going to go, "Ooh, this terroir. This is definitely from Elgin versus Grabeau." But you are going to, when you open a bottle of wine, if you have the proper bent, you are going to be able to say, "Hold on a second, this is definitely a Cabernet. It's definitely from Stellenbosch," and that's what Stellenbosch is best known for example. And it's this ability to put wine into a bottle and ship it all over the world and create this wonderful calling card for South Africa globally. And in turn, people who sample these wonderful wines go, "Oh, I must go and see where this grape was grown." And it brings in tourism, it brings in visitors, it brings in foreign exchange. And that's the wonder of wine, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think that's also one of the main driving factors for the museum, is we wanted to create a space where we really celebrate wine, and specifically South African wine, because we do produce such wonderful wines in this country. And I think it's not well known enough internationally. And we have guests coming from all over the world who are really having this incredible experience in our museum, saying, it's such a fun thing. And it's also, we try to break down the stigma around wine as a subject which is intimidating, and it's only for the experts. So we really try and engage with it in a fun and lighthearted way.
Talk to me about the bottles, talk to me about the glass, talk to me about the history and the evolution of the vessels in which wine was created and served over time.
So Etienne Honnekom, our designer who helped us design the space, came up with a wonderful collection of glassware that we have on display in the museum. And we also have a wonderful collection of old bottles. And the prize piece in the museum is a bottle of Vin de Constance from 1821, which is the year that Napoleon Bonaparte passed away. And he was guessed to have consumed about one bottle a day. If you were to go by,
if you're going to go, there are worse ways of going.
Exactly.
Now, so was it called Vin de Constance in those days? Because it's been recreated by Klein Constantia, of course, in the last 30 years as Vin de Constance. It was then, is the original label still visible? Was it imprinted on the bottle? Is it Vin de Constance?
Absolutely, it's still the same product, same wine, same name.
Has anybody, because it is possible to take a very, 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 very thin syringe and to pierce the cork, or maybe go down the side between the cork and the bottle, and to take out just a tiniest little swippy to see what it tastes like? Has anybody done that?
Not with our bottle in particular, but I'm sure they would be able to. But we're a little bit precious with our bottle, so it's under lock and key in a glass case.
And it is, it's a wonderful heirloom, isn't it? I mean, this is a 200-year-old bottle of wine. It's not priceless. I think one went on auction fairly recently and sold for a decent amount of money. And it's wonderful to have that as part of the legacy, of course, of South Africa's extraordinary wine industry. Do you sort of keep wine sales hours? How, if somebody was to come to the Bobby Dawn Store and Wine Museum, which only opened in March this year, what sort of hours do you keep? When is it open?
So we're open every day. We operate at the same hours of the tasting room, which at the moment is about 10 to 5 for visitors looking to, also you can do a tasting in our tasting room or do a cellar tour, which I highly recommend as a add-on to your museum experience. And yeah, so we're open 7 days a week.
How many corkscrews have you got?
Oh my gosh, now you ask a question that I...
There must be 400. I mean, I'm just looking
there
at these.
You know, we've got an enormous collection. However, the exact number escapes me now, but it is a wonderful collection that we bought from a gentleman in South Africa, and it's got an amazing variety. And we also showcase in the museum the evolution of the patents of the different corkscrews.
And I wonder if any single one of them works properly, because corkscrews are a pain in the neck. Jeez, like they're terrible things. I'm sure there's one of them.
One should hope that at least one of them works. But it's actually quite interesting to sort of note that the basic technology doesn't really change that much.
You screw a piece of metal into a cork and use brute force to extract it. And depending on your levels of desperation, it either happens quickly or slowly, or the cork crumbles. Elsa, it's a wonderful museum. Thank you very much for sharing with us this evening. Elsa Fuchs, who is the museologist at Bobby Dawn Store, which is a beautiful, beautiful property. It's not, again, it goes way beyond just the wine museum, which is brand new since March this year. They've got several restaurants there. Just the water reticulation system through Bobby Dawn Store, and you go there, and Chris Becker, obsessed with history and obsessed with legacy, has done a number of things, and I forget exactly, but there's a cutting from a grapevine, and it may be a Persian grapevine that maybe originates from the original grapevines of humanity or something. But certainly what there is in the garden at Bobby Dawn Store is a cutting from a fig tree in the Garden of Gethsemane, which, if you know your biblical history, you will know that the Garden of Gethsemane is where Judas betrayed Jesus Christ by kissing him on the cheek. And so that's got historical significance. And Chris Becker certainly has invested very, very heavily in Bobby Dawn Store. And you can stay there, you can drink the wine, you can buy the fruit and veg and get it delivered to your home if you live in the Western Cape. But it certainly is a wonderful sort of tribute to South Africa's wine industry. And it's a fraught industry. It really does. There's a horrible and dark underbelly to the industry. However, the legacy of those who sacrificed so much to create that industry is something which creates an enormous amount of joy, employment and tax revenue here in the 21st century. In a moment, let's play the Brutal Biz quiz, because it is Friday night. 021-446-0567, 011-883-0702. I would like to know, who's the new boss of the National Treasury? The Director General. In this case, just an acting Director General. We'll be back with you with answers to that question in a mo.
702.
Bruce is on Twitter at Bruce Business.
Lines are open. Let's play the Brutal Biz Quiz on The Money Show this evening, brought to you by Absa CIB, building investment and growing businesses in Africa. The bravery to imagine, that's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. Who is the acting Director General at National Treasury? Up first this evening is Ahmed in Joburg South. Ahmed, who is the DG?
I heard you interviewing Ishmael Momanya.
Ishmael Momoniat, absolutely right, otherwise known as Momo. He has been at National Treasury for 27 years, 22 of those years. So since the year 2000, he's been in various leadership positions as a Deputy Director General, and he doesn't want the job full time because he's got proper work to do. In economics, we refer to it on The Money Show most days. It's not perfect, but it is the way that we measure the size and the value of an economy. What are the three letters that we utilize to say this is the size or the value of the economy?
Probably GDP.
Probably GDP would be absolutely right. Gross domestic product, GDP. You are correct. That's why there are applause. We don't applaud failure, Ahmed. We don't applaud. If you get it wrong, we boo and hiss.
No,
that's what we do. That's what we do. President Cyril Ramaphosa's Pala Pala Farm can be found near which Limpopo town?
I wouldn't know. I really wouldn't know, but I know I'll find $4 million there.
Well, I'm not sure if it's all there anymore. But Pala Pala is near a place with two names. It's also a repeat. Used to be called Warm Baths. Today it's called?
I wouldn't know. Sorry, I don't know. Sorry.
Don't apologize, Ahmed.
I still know it is Warm Baths. Thank you.
Ahmed, you've got to come back to the 21st century now. You've got to join us in the 21st century. All the cool kids know it. Refill where as what?
Bila Bila.
Bila Bila. Absolutely right. Pala Pala near Bila Bila. You liked it so much that you put twice as much money in the sofa. Members of the Ankole Cattle Breeders Society of South Africa preparing for the national auction. 200 lots of game will be auctioned off to the highest bidders, hopefully by EFT. SPP is the JSE share trading code of which retailer? If you think of, I can't think of any off the top of my head now, actually. But SPP, each share on the JSE has got a share trading code. SPP is the code of which company? It's a retailer. Refill where? Which one?
ShopRite.
SHP is ShopRite. So I'm afraid not. Refill where? Which means I am the winner of the Brutal Biz Quiz this evening. SPP is the share trading code of Spar Group. Absolutely, Spar Group. It has been in the news this week. Results out from Spar. Big problems still in Switzerland and Poland in their operations there, but doing well, pretty well across the UK and Ireland where they've got operations, and also getting into this mad rush now of home deliveries. I used a home delivery this morning. I felt very in touch with my mobile phone, and it worked, and it was brilliant. I'm not going to disclose which one, but it was very, very good. And it arrived early. All the stuff that I ordered was there in the quantities that I ordered, and the correct measurements of the goods that I ordered. I just forgot the charcoal. Would they deliver charcoal? Maybe that's too big. I don't know. Anyway, that is it for the first hour of The Money Show for this evening. Back with you in a few moments after Eyewitness News, bringing you the best bits from the week that has been here on The Money Show.